Next, we will hear from Saladin Muhammad, who is from the Black Workers for Justice, headquartered in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And he will come before you at this time to talk a bit about the current struggles being waged by his particular organization, as well as to deal with some additional comments about other struggles going on in the South. And we would like at this time to welcome him.
Good afternoon. I got to bear with me. I'm always nervous when I'm trying to deal with critical questions. So I'm going to try to do the best I can in the interest of moving forward. I want to first make a couple of remarks that
you can buy a pack, and what you will get involved for that is a Malcolm button, the official conference T-shirt, as well as a glossy poster that you see reproduced on various pieces of literature around the conference. It's a tremendous bargain, and it's also a way for you to assist us in raising some of the monies to make up for the tremendous cost of this conference. Next, we will hear from Saladin Muhammad, who is from the Black Workers for Justice, headquartered in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and he will come before you at this time to talk a bit about the current struggles being waged by his particular organization, as well as to deal with some additional comments about other struggles going on in the South. And we would like at this time to welcome him.
Good afternoon. I got to bear with me. I'm always nervous when I'm trying to deal with critical questions. So I'm going to try to do the best I can in the interest of moving forward. I want to first make a couple of remarks that I think it has been a real serious problem, and it really reflects a weakness in the way we make analysis. When every time there's an analysis made about the material conditions of the South, it is always viewed as some ideological polemic. Our ability to really analyze the political economy of this country, to understand, you know, how imperialism has been able to be strong, requires that we be prepared to make a sober analysis and not to be biased because of our particular ideological tendency against this or that way of thinking. Because independent of what we think, there's some real concrete conditions that exist in the South and that exist in the world that an effective analysis to advance our struggle must consider and must be based on. There's some thinking that, and I'm not a historian, but, you know, certainly a lot of the history has been covered. But I think if we look at the 50s and 60s, there's a view that the defeat of the of legal segregation, apartheid, USA, has represented the end of the solid South. That is the uniform pattern and practices of Southern states in its treatment of the African-American masses. The reality of it is, the economic realities is that the solid South essentially is united in terms of African-American people being concentrated in a super exploited and a subjugated way. Some economists estimate that in 1984, the super profit that was made off of the oppression of the African-American people throughout this country was $91 billion, half of which came from the South. But they also estimated that all of U.S. foreign investments taken together, its returns brought back $96 billion. So that says something about the oppression of African American people in this country, and the particular character of the oppression in the South. Now, that ain't got nothing to do with ideology. That's got something to do with the fact that this is a very powerful thing that we're dealing with, whatever we may think. The oppression of African American people in the South, even the gap between black and white workers in the South, you know, shows that even of the working class in the South, that African American people are the most exploited in the South. And thus, it is our super exploitation which more defines the character of the whole working class in the South, the white working class in the South, and not the highest stage of development of the U.S. capitalist system. Because if we try to look at the working class in the South from the standpoint of the highest stage of development of the U.S. capitalist system, we will think, essentially, that the white working class in the South has its interest more with the white working class in the North and not with the struggle of the African American masses for national liberation in the South. Because that is the reality of its condition, because it has also been victimized by the role that the South has played in the development of the U.S. imperialist economy. Following the Korean War, U.S. corporations developed manufacturing plants throughout the world, mainly in the Third World, employing 7 million workers following the Korean War. Let's ask the question, why didn't U.S. imperialism expand its manufacturing section to the South, to the Black Belt South, following the Korean War? I think when we look at the 60s, the late 60s and the 70s, we find the answer. Again, it's independent of ideology. We saw that the alignment, the anti-imperialist alignment was taking shape in Africa, Asia, and Latin America around the Vietnam War, which threw the greatest resources of U.S. imperialism in trying to win that war, thus weakening its support of the colonial powers in Africa, Portugal, and the rest, tilting the balance of power to send the African liberation struggles on the offensive there. Following the Vietnam War and during the Vietnam War, when you start to see the African liberation struggles develop, you saw a hell of a retreat of a number of corporations that had plants throughout Asia and Africa. And where did they come? They came to the South. So we begin to see that the South has historically been kept underdeveloped so that it could serve as a reserve to enable imperialism to develop and not be so easily destabilized because of its internationalization of capital. It has essentially played the role of a colony, an internal colony. I'm not arguing, you understand, all of the A's and B's of what a colony is. But that's what happened. But when we analyze what industries came in the South during the late 60s and the 70s, we find out that it was not only U.S. corporations, but it was the corporations of developed capitalist imperialist countries who were also in Africa, Asia, and in Latin America. There's more than 1,000 foreign-owned industries in the South today. Japan, Germany, Britain, right in the South. That means that the oppression of the South is not merely a factor of U.S. imperialism, it's a factor of the international imperialist system. It means, you understand, that the South, you understand, is subjugated and nationally oppressed like a semi-colony. Again, we're not arguing ideas. We're arguing what the materialist reality is in this country. The restructuring of the U.S. economy taking shape in the 70s we saw that major industry in the North were being not absolutely phased out, but decentralized. If you remember, the first wave, you understand, you know, of restructuring was when you saw major departments of plants being phased out. And therefore, you had plants only making part of the commodity. Well, there were new plants who were subcontractors developing in the South, making it look like, you know, there was some there was a different industrial character. But let me show you a phenomenon that we experienced in the South, in North Carolina. You got workers who work in the automobile industry, who make dashboards, who don't have industrial consciousness, because we don't, our relationship to the centers of U.S. capital is different. They think they belong to the dashboard industry. They think they belong to the windshield industry. They think they belong to the rubber molding industry. This is not ideological, brothers and sisters. This is based on a material relationship to the centers of U.S. imperialism and a role of the South and how we must understand it. It's not an ideological question. But what has anchored the South, shaped its character, and produced the most consistent social and progressive movement in the South? It's been the oppression, the national oppression of the African American people. That has been the basis of bringing about democracy and social progress, not only for the African American people in the South, but for the whole working class in the South. The national movement, the Southern movement, still exists in the South. But like any other movement, it has its own problems. It has fragmentation, disunity, it's a law, you got repressive forces, you understand, that's intimidating people. But it don't mean that the material basis of that movement don't exist. And that's what we have to deal with today. Let me move forward. Please have patience with me. So we see how the war helped to tilt the balance of power in favor of oppressed people's struggles against U.S. imperialism. Now, in the 70s, we also saw that the trade union movement was on the defensive. Now, how do you have a movement that only represents 15% of the whole U.S. working class be on the defensive, and it certainly was on the defensive in areas, you understand, where the center, where the highest stage of capitalism had developed, but in the Black Belt South and the South, you had virtually no unions in the main. Therefore, it weakened the workers' movement, it weakened the trade union movement throughout the rest of the country. Therefore, when we talk about the working class struggle and all our views are based on the workers of the vanguard, etc., well, we don't realize how weakened the organizations of the working class, how in fact weak the trade unions are. You got a trade union in the so-called most democratic country in the world that ain't got a labor party. It says something about how strong it is. I'm pro-trade union, I ain't anti, I'm absolutely pro. But the gains of the civil rights movement, the civil rights period, in order for us to advance in the South and throughout the rest of the country, then the balance of power must be affected. Anytime you got workers who can't wear a vote for Jackson button or to work without fear of losing their job, anytime a worker can't be on the picket line fighting against racist education in the schools because their boss is going to intimidate them, it means that the balance of power is not such that we can advance beyond the civil rights movement. That means that the workers from this movement who work in the shop, who can't stand with their children to fight against racist education, and because the trade union movements are on the defensive, have no choice but to come forward to take the lead to build worker structures and trade unions in order to affect that balance of power. And this is what is being produced gradually. coming from the most only progressive movement that has the democratic ideas that welcomes all people. The civil rights, the black power, the African American National Liberation Movement. This is the tendency that we represent. It's not no ideological tendency. We ain't no party. We are coming from the working class, you know, as workers organizing. This is going to be the balance of power that we will need as we reunite the local struggles in the South and move forward challenging a South now that has a lot of industries, you know, that's going to intimidate the whole African American people by intimidating the African American working class. Wives, husbands, children, aunts, uncles, preachers, or nobody supports you when they say, well, you're automatically going to lose your job without a challenge. The question of the balance of power requires that our movement, the African American movement, you understand, be pro-trade union, pro-working class, and we come forward and organize those structures, or our ideas ain't going to do us no good. We're going to be isolated and wiped out. This serves the interests of empowering the whole working class throughout the country. This defines the role of the South. This defines the role of the African American movement in the South, which is the most oppressed section and vanguard of the entire African American people's movement in this country for national liberation. This defines the role. It means then that the organization of the African American National Liberation Movement must organize itself nationally throughout the country, but it must also organize itself in a concentrated way in the South, which is united with its national character, but that enables it to be able to address the particular contradictions that grow out of where it is being oppressed in relationship to the oppression of all African people and American people in this country by U.S. imperialism. And I think that's what we have to look at. And lastly, let me close by saying this, that the purely local, therefore, race, the struggle against racism is a central aspect of our struggle. But our struggle is not a race struggle. It is a national liberation struggle. Race is a central and fundamental aspect of it. But underdevelopment, no power, these are questions which help define our national character, on national oppression. And if we don't understand that, then we're going to be confused all the time as leading a race struggle. We are a national liberation struggle. And our liberation, you understand, is the interest of all people. It certainly must be in our interests. But we believe that it is a democratic struggle in the interest of all people. And our struggle in the South, as a part of the struggle throughout the country, aims at freeing from U.S. imperialism and world imperialism the process of further developing society. Cabral said the process of developing the national productive forces so that people can have a better life to live. This is what our struggle represents. Therefore, the weight of imperialism, the weight of the crisis, the restructuring of the economy means that it will be extremely difficult for us to simply advance our struggle in the South through purely local forms of organization. Struggle in Rocky Mountain, a struggle in here. These are important struggles, but we must focus on uniting these struggles here. We must focus on uniting them. Therefore, it is not the time, you understand, for us to just declare ourselves the vanguard, because no group has a base strong enough to affect the balance of power in the interest of our movement. We have to unite to unite through uniting the mass base of our movement. And it's on the basis of that, that some kind of vanguard that's tied, consolidated, united with the people and the demands will be built. And then we will be the beacon for all oppressed and progressive and working class people throughout this country and possibly throughout this world. Thank you.